I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times.
What's up, people? I'm Carl Nassib. I'm at my house here in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Just want to take a quick moment to say that I'm gay. I've been meaning to do this for a while now, but I finally feel comfortable enough to get it off my chest. I really have the best life. I got the best family, friends, and job a guy could ask for. I'm a pretty private person, so I hope you guys know that I'm really not doing this for attention. I just think that representation and visibility are so important. I actually hope that, like, one day videos like this and the whole coming out process are just not necessary. But until then, you know, I'm going to do my best and do my part to cultivate a culture that's accepting, that's compassionate. And I'm going to start by donating $100,000 to the Trevor Project. They're an incredible organization. They're the number one suicide prevention service for LGBTQ youth in America. And they're truly doing incredible things. And I'm very excited to be a part of it, to help in any way that I can. And I'm really pumped to see what the future holds.
That was Carl Nassib, a defensive lineman for the Las Vegas Raiders, on Instagram earlier this week. He is the first active player in the NFL to publicly announce that he is gay. Other NFL players have come out in the past, but that was after their careers were over. Nassib has local connections, growing up in Westchester, graduating from Malvern Prep, and later graduating from Penn State. The response from the league and, frankly, most of the country has been overwhelmingly positive. Commissioner Roger Goodell said the NFL family is proud of Carl and shared his hope that someday soon statements like his will no longer be newsworthy. Alex Reamer joins us by Skype. He's deputy managing editor at OutSports. That's a website focused on LGBT issues and athletes in professional and amateur sports. And Alex Reamer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we want to hear from you as well. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Alex, are you surprised that the NFL has been so welcoming to Carl Nassib?
No, I'm not surprised at all. None of us are really surprised at OutSports, Marty. We cover these issues on a daily basis. We tell the stories of LGBTQ athletes, as we mentioned. And when you talk about athletes coming out, we're really only talking about the male team sports at high levels that have been behind. We have out athletes in high school, college, women's sports, international levels, etc. But the interesting thing is, the NFL and all the major leagues at the corporate level have been very pro-LGBTQ for many years. It was over half a decade ago where the NFL threatened to move a Super Bowl out of Atlanta if Georgia passed an anti-LGBTQ ordinance. They applied similar pressure to Arizona as well. So the NFL on the corporate level has been welcoming for a long time. This past October, they recorded a video for National Coming Out Day starring several NFL stars. So we knew that the NFL and the sports world at large was ready for this. And as you mentioned, the reaction to Carl Nassib is proving that to be true.
Well, he did talk about that effect. It took 15 years. So obviously there was something. This is June, so it's Pride Month.
Right.
There was obviously something about this moment that felt right for him.
Yeah, undoubtedly. And he said it in one of his posts that this would not have been possible without his teammates and his coaches and their support. And yeah, the coming out story is different for everybody, Marty. We all go through it at different times. And the stories that we like to tell at OutSports are about the elation after you come out. You know, when you read about coming out stories, especially in high-level male team sports, there's so much coverage of the fear, the what-ifs. What if a player comes out? Will they not be accepted? Will they lose endorsements? And there's all the coverage on that side. But then when it happens, it's oftentimes the best thing they've ever done. So, again, I think you're seeing that with Carl. But everybody has a different time. And he says that he's a private person. But he wants to do this for visibility, which is so important as well, because now if you're a gay football player, you can, a gay in high school or college, you can say, hey, there's somebody like me in the NFL.
Well, do you imagine other NFL players will come out like Carl Nassib?
It's tough to say, obviously, but it takes the first. And as I mentioned, there was that fear for a long time. If a player comes out, would he lose endorsements? Would he be heckled in opposing stadiums? Would other players in the league shun him? Those fears were all out there, and we didn't really have a test case because, as you mentioned before I came on, the only NFL players who had come out up to this point had done so after they retired. We had Michael Sam a few years ago, but he never made an NFL roster. So we never had a test case. Carl Nassib is now a test case, and this week his jersey has been the number one seller across the league. So I think that tells you all you need to know.
Here's a comment on our Facebook page from one of our listeners. Can someone please explain why it is just so important to know this? I mean, really, who cares? And why is it my business to know his personal business? Hold on there, Alex. It's not my business. Why is this? I mean, it's sort of news and not news at the same time, but why is this important?
I love that rebuttal and or that response rather. And my rebuttal to that would be, tell me the suicide rate for LGBTQ youth and compare that to the suicide rate to the general population. LGBTQ youth, far higher suicide rate. Why? Because there's a lack of visibility. There's a lack of acceptance. Studies show that if LGBTQ kids have at least one accepting adult in their life, one, I'm not talking about 12, one, their chance of suicide decreases by 40%. So until those numbers come down, we need as much visibility as possible. That's why it's important for Carl Nassib to come out and other figures as well.
And I would add to that, non-LGBTQ youth, it also sends a message to them.
Of course, it totally does. And like I go back to again, a kid on a Pop Warner team or a high school team. Carl Nassib's a real player. He has 20 and a half sacks over the last 6 years, and now he is out and openly gay. And the idea that you can't be openly gay and play football is, again, he's helping to eradicate that. Absolutely.
You mentioned Pop Warner. Let me quote from Warren Moon. He was interviewed this week on NBC News, and he said he played and I'm such not a football sports person. He's played from 84 to 2000. So that puts this a little bit in context. But here's what he said. You're taught at a very young age, as far back as Pop Warner, don't show weakness, don't show injuries. If you were ever to say that you were gay, that would be like you were considered soft. I understand why guys wouldn't come forward just because of the mentality of the sport that they've been taught for so long. True?
Yes, because throughout history, what has been synonymous with gay men? They're effeminate, they're wimpy, they're weak, right? Their casual homophobia is so prevalent in locker rooms across the country at pretty much every level. So that's exactly what Warren Moon is talking about, that contrast. And again, someone like Carl Nassib, who is not just an NFL player, by the way, he's a defensive lineman. I mean, he can't get more hulkier and all-American than that, right? And he's coming out as openly gay. And again, the more examples we have of this, the more those stereotypes get eradicated.
This is kind of a speculative question, but one wonders whether he will be either a better player or a different player now that he's out.
That's an interesting question. And I can only speak from my personal experience, but I think that being closeted held me back professionally and personally immensely, and especially professionally. I'm a sports writer. I'm a talk radio host. If I wasn't able to genuinely talk about my feelings on Carl Nassib, if I was still closeted talking about this story, my work wouldn't be as good because I wouldn't truly be writing from the heart. You feel free once you come out. So obviously I'm not Carl Nassib. I can't say for sure, but I think, yeah, there's a weight lifted off your shoulders and the world is more open than it was previously.
So how did you come out? What was your process for coming out?
It was a multi-pronged process. So I came out to my friends and family before my junior year of college, and that went great. It was very accepting. And then professionally, I came out on Boston Sports Talk Radio in 2016, and it was kind of a spur-of-the-moment thing. I was a guest on a show, and the host asked me if there was something the listeners didn't know about me. And I said, you know what? This is my moment to tell my truth and be who I am, because if I want to succeed at this job, I have to be honest. So I just blurted out, I'm gay. And honestly, Marty, I didn't think anything of it. I'm lucky. I live in Boston. I have a great family, great friends, great support. I never even thought that it would impact my career in sports media being openly gay. I'm 28. So that just shows you the progress that we've made in such a short time as well.
And the response from the fans?
I was not the most popular personality on this station, but that was for my views rather than my sexuality, I think. It was all good. Yes, incredible support. It made me feel great. And it's great to see what Carl's getting as well.
It is interesting to look at women's professional sports compared to men's professional sports and to see many more out women playing soccer and others, Megan Rapinoe, the most obvious example of that. Does that tell us something about sports?
Yeah, well, I have two answers. Number one, I mean, the women, as you know, Marty, are always ahead of the men in pretty much everything. So we'll begin with that. But secondly, it does go to that stereotype, right? I mean, gay women playing sports. That's always been a stereotype. And as a result, I feel like it may be easier to come out in that environment because there's not that contrast. Whereas, as we were just saying, in upper high level male team professional sports, you're gay. That's an insult that's thrown around fields all the time. So I think that explains it as well.
He says, I'm a private person, and he's asked, you know, to be essentially left alone. I thought it was interesting that he did it on Instagram. It wasn't a press conference. I mean, he did it on his own terms.
Yeah, I love that. And he starts it off with, what's up, people? I mean, find me something more, right? More casual than that. And yeah, I love that there was no press conference, no tortured feature story. This is just a guy who, as you were saying earlier, said, this is the time after 15 years, I want to come out. I'm going to do it on Instagram, on my own channel, on my own time. So yes, it was very indicative of the times in which we live as well.
If you could interview him, and I realize the season is starting, you know, relatively soon, what would you want to know? What would you want to ask him? Would it be anything to do with this coming out, or would it just be about, not just, but about football?
My first question would be, I think, the most simple one. How do you feel? You know, I mean, I separate my life, you know, the BC and AD. Well, I have pre coming out and after coming out. And I feel like I was living two different lives. And that's what I want to hear about Carl. Do you feel like you can be freer personally and professionally? Do you feel like the world has opened up to you? Do you feel like you are no longer suppressing a part of your personal life? What's your journey like now as an openly gay man? Those are the kind of things that I would be most interested in knowing.
You mentioned the NFL, and we're almost out of time here, but I'm interested also in Commissioner Roger Goodell, obviously, you know, welcoming him and being very proud of what Carl Nassib said. Again, does that surprise you? Does that just tell us something about the NFL today?
It doesn't surprise me. Roger Goodell has a gay brother, so he's always been supportive of the LGBTQ issues. And that's another reason why coming out is so important, because everybody who comes out has a brother, has a sister, has a mother, has a father, has coworkers, has friends, roommates, etc. So that's another reason why visibility is so important. But yes, the NFL, as I mentioned, has been open and supportive of LGBTQ causes for many years. They turned the shield, the iconic shield, rainbow for Pride Month. Give me a bigger stamp of endorsement than that. And I also thought it was great, by the way, that the NFL donated $100,000 to the Trevor Project this week, matching Carl Nassib's donation. That's the leading suicide prevention group for LGBTQ youth. So the NFL in that case is certainly putting its money where its mouth is as well, which is the most important thing.
Well, Alex Reamer, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And he's deputy managing editor of OutSports. It's a website focused on LGBT issues and athletes in professional and amateur sports. We've got Stephen Petro waiting in the wings. He's a columnist. He's an author. He writes for a number of publications. We'll be talking more about what I was talking with Alex about. We'll also talk about Stephen's new book, Stupid Things I Won't Do When I Get Old. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me just recap. Raiders defensive lineman Carl Nassib came out this week, the first active NFL player to go public about being gay. He said he had agonized over the decision and was donating $100,000 to the Trevor Project. That's a nonprofit that focuses on suicide prevention for LGBTQ youth. As we were just discussing, the response to his announcement has been overwhelmingly positive. We asked Stephen Petro to join us. He's past president of NLGJA, the Association of LGBTQ Journalists, and has written extensively on a wide range of LGBTQ issues. He writes for The Washington Post and USA Today and is a regular contributor to The New York Times. He's also got a new book, which we will talk about. It's called Stupid Things I Won't Do When I Get Old. It's a series of personal essays about how to grow old with your dignity intact. And Stephen Petro, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Do we have
Marty, great to be back with you too.
Okay, that's great. I hope we don't have a big delay here. Let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.com.
I'm right here.
Okay, he's not hearing us for some reason. We will get him hooked up. In the meantime, I will just make sure that our listeners can join our conversation. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. We're going to spend the first part of our conversation talking about this announcement by Carl Nassib because of the fact that Stephen Petro has written so much about LGBTQ issues. And then we'll be talking about stupid things I won't do when I get old. And that's the title of his new book. So we're going to cover a lot of territory. I got some thumbs up. And Stephen Petro, a long introduction, but nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
And glad to be here. I've been able to hear you the whole time.
Okay, so very good. Well, there I was on the air, filling airtime. Let me ask you just briefly, you were listening in as I was talking with Alex Reamer about Nassib coming out. And I wonder just from your perspective, having written so much on LGBTQ issues, what do you make of the announcement, I guess the response to his announcement?
Well, you know, I think it's a very moving announcement for many people, and I agree with much of what Alex had to say. I think the only thing that I would really add is that we need to look at these individuals coming out in the context of what's happening in this country in terms of LGBTQ rights and really the attack on LGBTQ people. Mm-hmm. This year is looking to be the worst in terms of the number of state laws that will be harmful to queer people. 8 states have already passed laws, and 10 more are on the books. And then, you know, Carl is, he's a hero, he's a football player, and he's white. Yeah. And it's always important in these issues to look at communities of color and to realize that there are differences and that white privilege does matter. And it's certainly making for a smoother transition for someone like Carl Nassib. And we just sort of need to broaden our perspective on all of this.
I appreciate you saying that. It is an interesting juncture because on the one hand, you've got a Gallup poll, finding that 70% of Americans support same-sex marriage. And then on the other hand, as you mentioned, we've got all these sort of anti-gay actions that are counter to that.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, part of the continuing blowback since marriage equality became the law in 2015. You know, there was 3 steps forward, and then there's really been these state-by-state attacks that were also led by the previous president to undermine that and to undermine equality. And, you know, this is a trite saying that people often do say, but for gay people, we know we can get married on Sunday, and we know in most states we can get fired on Mondays because we do not have protection for our sexual orientation or our gender identity. And so those are strides that still need to be made, and that's why the Equality Act is such an important law, because it will provide equal protection for everyone, regardless of their identity or orientation.
Well, and that is true in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, wonderful.
I'm just curious, and then we will talk about your book, about your coming out, what that was like. You're, you know, a lot older than Carl Nassib. Sorry.
Yes, I could be Carl's daddy, I guess, but you know, for my generation, and I'm 63 now, I've been coming out really my whole life. I remember, you know, first coming out to my parents and then coming out in the workplace and then coming out in new workplaces and when I would move. So for many people, it's not, you know, it's not just coming out on the radio, which is a big thing because you're doing it really to a lot of people, as Alex did. But it's incremental, and you kind of build on that. And then at a certain point, I was out in my work and as president of NLGJA, and there was no going back in at that point. But, you know, it's much easier for many people now, but it's still very challenging for a good number. And I hear from them, and I hear about the bullying and being estranged from families and the disproportionate mental health issues for LGBTQ people. So It's a big picture and it's a complex picture.
Indeed. Well, let's talk about your book, Stupid Things I Won't Do When I Get Old. And I got stuck on that word old. It's so loaded, right? I mean, it's a number, it's wrinkles, it's your body, it's your mind. What does old mean to you? As you said, you're in your 60s. Do you feel old?
Well, I do not feel old. And, you know, part of the book is to really sort of counter the associations that we have with the word old and with the notion of being older. We tend to conflate older with illness. They're actually very different things. Illness is not good. Older is another stage of life, like pregnancy, like midlife. And so I'm hoping that through telling these stories, my stories, my parents' stories, other stories, we can see that there are different ways to understand this time. And, an example I will often tell is the organ recital where people 50 plus, and it happened to me last night. I had some friends over and we're all talking about our aches and pains and this and that. And I said, look, guys, we have to stop. You know, we do not want to be defined by this. And especially if other people are listening to us, that's not who we are. You know, we may have this ache and pain, but that does not define us.
Well, I love that you call it an organ recital because it is a matter of dealing with all those organs that don't work the way they used to, right?
Right, exactly. And there's a large chorus with all of this, too.
Well, you know, you wrote an article about 4 years ago in 2017 where it essentially looked at your parents, and you were a younger person then, saying, I don't want to be like them. But in certain ways, it's almost inevitable that we're going to do some of the things that our parents did when they got older.
Well, it may be. But what I did 4 years ago was I had been keeping this list of things that I thought they were doing wrong. And this, when you were mentioning the name of the title, it brings sort of somewhere between, a smile and a smirk because it's kind of it's a little bit in your face. And
yes.
I'm trying to sort of use humor to talk about difficult issues around aging, around illness. But, there were things like my mother, she loved her throw rugs. And my father was falling. We couldn't get her to pick up the rugs. They started hoarding the butter pats when they would go out to restaurants as though they were going to run out of either butter or food, instead of starting to, get rid of things so that after they passed, which they have, their kids didn't have to, do all this unloading. They constantly said, well, we don't want to be a burden to you kids. And then they made decisions that were burdensome, even though we love them. So I was writing all this down, and I was hoping to be able to do better myself. I've done better on some. I'm probably going to follow in their footsteps on others.
Yeah.
But by raising this sort of awareness of the decisions we make every day, I'm hoping that we will actually be able to live healthier and live longer. And the reason I say that, Marty, is there are studies that show if we internalize the bad parts about being old, we get sick more often. We have more mental health issues. And we live shorter lives. So it's kind of important to tweak that.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Stephen Petro, and we're talking about his new book. It's called Stupid Things I Won't Do When I Get Old. He's a columnist and author. He writes it for The Washington Post, The New York Times, USA Today. And he's been a guest on Radio Times in the past talking about things like manners. And again, you can join us, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us 1-888-477-9499. And we want to hear about the things that you're not going to do when you get old. Stephen, you talk about sort of everyday ageism, and I think we all, and I would include myself, we all sort of do this without thinking, that we say things about either older people or the aging process that really is hostile, aggressive sometimes, that I think we would not say about other groups or ages of people.
Yeah, in the research I did for this book, it became clear that ageism is really the last acceptable ism. We know that racism is wrong. We know that homophobia, misogyny, all of those types of isms are, problematic. But we make fun of older people. They're technologically incompetent. Someone sent me this meme this week, and they thought it was funny. And they know I kind of write about this. And it was an older woman and her mobile phone. And it says, how does grandma unfriend someone on her phone? And then what the illustration showed was she had a bottle of whiteout and she was painting over.
Right. I hear you.
Yeah. Sorry, we had a little blip there. There's these types of sort of humor around the birthday cards. And all of this kind of just mounts in addition to the discrimination out there in the world around health issues and employment issues. So it aggregates and it hurts us.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned birthday cards. I hate those birthday cards about old geezers and wrinkles and, you know, you can't remember anything. But when you go to that rack to get a birthday card for someone who is older, there they are.
I know. And I was guilty of this, too, until recently. I thought, they're kind of funny. And then I started getting a bunch of them myself. And I was like, this is really not funny. They're kind of implying, I'm falling apart. I'm like a few years from the end. And don't really want to be encouraging that. We don't do that around other issues. So those are choices we can make. And, we need to be aware before we make a choice. And then we hopefully will make a better choice. And that's how it goes.
How much do you think about your appearance, your changing appearance?
I will tell you, there's a chapter in the book, and it's based on a conversation I had with the ABC News anchor, Diane Sawyer, a while ago. And she told me, anchors don't get older, they just get blonder. And I was at the age where I was beginning to become a silver fox, but I decided to color my hair, and it was a disaster. And especially for men, it can be a disaster. So there's a lot of acceptance that I think is necessary about one's body, one's face, and it's made me feel better to be able to do that. I don't color my hair anymore, and I imagine that if I had a colorist as good as Diane Sawyer's, I might. But this is really about coming to terms with who we are and that, we've earned the lives and the faces that we have. I also talk about having a number of scars from various surgeries over my lifetime. And when I was much younger, I was very self-conscious of those scars. And, now I sort of see them as badges of courage. I survived all of those procedures and illnesses. And here I am. And we all have sort of that metaphoric scar, whether it's a physical or a mental one.
In fact, you say, I will look at myself naked in the mirror.
I do.
And you do.
I mean, that sounds like I'm a narcissist. It's not like...
Right, exactly. No, I understand. Say,
I can. And, because I many of us have, what we think are disfigurements, but they're part of our beauty. And, I think if we can see things a little bit differently, we will feel better about ourselves.
Have you changed how you dress as you get older? I don't know if that's as much of an issue for men as it is for women, or if it's an issue at all.
Well, part of the largest issue is when you get older, you start to become invisible. And I think many people I know who are sort of 50, 60 plus, they take this in, and if they were sharp dressers or, if they wore jewelry or this or that, they kind of stopped doing that, thinking it's age inappropriate. And when I was in my 50s, my then husband told me I was dressing age inappropriate. I was wearing skinny jeans and a short blazer, and I felt that was part of my identity, but also part of what helped me to stay visible to myself and to others. So I took that cue from my mom. My mom was always a very stylish dresser, and well into her 80s, she always dressed, she always had her hair done, and those nails were jungle red until 2 weeks before she passed. And I think a lot of her own self-esteem came out of that, but she was saying to everyone, I am a presence. You will not ignore me.
Let me get Louise from Norristown to join our conversation. Hi, Louise. Go ahead. You're in Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to say I am a senior citizen, and my granddaughter, who is 26, is astonished at how active my husband and I are. But she was only familiar with the nursing homes that her great-grandparents were involved, were in living in. And it's just we find that the more active we are, the more fun we have. And even though our friends may be 80 or more, sometimes they can beat us at pickleball and golf. So it's just, I think I'm enjoying this period of my life. And I think the more active you are mentally and physically, the better off you are.
Louise, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Stephen Petro, first of all, she says that her granddaughter is surprised at how active she is. But nonetheless, I mean, I think that's an important thing to talk about when it comes to older people.
Absolutely. And Louise, you're a great role model to her, because she will now know that when she gets to be your age, she can be as active and as passionate in activities. And that's a really important lesson. And I think it's also the lesson that, you know, Marty, for our generation, this age group is very different than what it was for our parents. We're going to live generally much longer than they did. And that's, you know, that's important to recognize and to build on.
Well, about a minute from our break, when I was younger and I saw people who are my age now, I thought they were old. And now that I am that particular age, you know, I don't feel old, although the number's a little shocking. But at the same time, I do think there's maybe it's the sort of boomerism that we brought into old ageism.
Well, we take on everything. And the good news actually here is that demographers now say old age starts in this country in our early 70s. So that's when you really kind of make that crossing the threshold. It's not the 60s anymore. So midlife goes all the way past 70, Marty. So I don't know your age, but we're all in.
I'm past that little mark. But anyway, that's all. It's all good. It's all good. Stephen, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Stephen Petro is our guest. His book is Stupid Things I Won't Do When I Get Old. He is a longtime columnist for The Washington Post. He also writes for The New York Times and USA Today. And we do want to hear from you. We want your stories, your comments. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. And if just joining us, Stephen Petro is our guest. He's got a new book, Stupid Things I Won't Do When I Get Old. And it's a series of personal essays about how to grow old with your dignity intact. Let me get Sally to join us. Sally calling us from the Philadelphia area. Sally, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, as usual, Marty, great show.
Thank you.
I just turned 72. I am a teacher. I've been teaching full-time. I just started my 52nd year.
Wow.
I recently let my hair, I stopped coloring my hair. It's a great gray. I wish I had stopped a long time ago. But people teach me, treat me differently.
Really? In what way?
Let me help you. I'll carry that down to your classroom for you. And I'm really... I think, I hate to say it, I'm more energetic than a lot of people in the building. But it's just a little, and I know gray is in, okay?
It is.
I don't feel it's in for me.
I hear you, Sally. No, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Well, what do you think, Stephen Petro?
Sally, I think you're beautiful, and I'm saying that on the radio, but and I laud you for doing that. And you know what I think? What I think you can do in circumstances like that is just very kindly say to the kind-hearted person, you know, I'm fine. You know, I'd be happy to help you if you need any help with something. You know, this is part of what ageism is, and people are unaware that they are doing it. And here you are, the exact same person, and now they're treating you differently because your hair is gray. That's the problem, and it's not your problem.
Sally, I appreciate the call to Radio Time. Stephen, there's something you said, and you write in this book that I circled because I thought it was such an important piece of advice as getting older, to have friends that are not your age, meaning younger friends.
Yes, and I took that from a life experience where when I was about 40, I met a woman named Denise Kessler, and she was in her late 70s. And she was interviewing me to rent an apartment of hers, but she was really interviewing me to become a friend of hers. And she was such an active person then. She lived to the age of 98, so we had a friendship of 20 years. But she was purposely cultivating younger people as a strategy. She knew that if she did live a long life, she might be left alone, and it turned out to be true. Her sisters died. She was divorced. And so having this coterie of young men and women to be friends and to help her with things was a great resource. But it was also wonderful for me to have a mentor and someone who I really saw as my peer. And she taught me about this concept of being a perennial. You know, we all have these labels these days, you know, a millennial, sure, a boomer, greatest generation. And I think those get in the way of actual, you know, contact and connection. But perennials can be any age. We can all be perennials. And it's really about the kind of attitude we have about life, you know, that Sally just evidenced, for instance. You know, being involved, being passionate, finding meaning, finding connection. And perennials bloom year after year after year. And that's what Denise was. And so I think having these cross-generation friendships and connections help everybody to stay connected.
I love that. I mean, perennial, that, you know, conjures up so many wonderful things. Here's Luann, who says she's offended by the Karen, you know, about Karen ridiculing older white women. Also offended at the Geico ads, you don't want to become your parents. Can you speak to that, Stephen?
Yes, and this is, again, you know, if we're not absent in advertising, then we're the butt of the joke. And, you know, advertisers have been very slow to sort of understand that this is disrespectful. And, you know, one of the chapters in the book is, I will not allow people to disrespect me. And that's such an important thing. And, you know, consider the fact that we've had, you know, decades of life experience. We've, you know, raised families, had jobs, and then to be not properly respected is adding insult to injury. And so, again, you know, I'm not trying to be a revolutionary, but there is a manifesto element to this book about awareness and changing our behaviors about what it means to be old and how we treat those in our midst who may be older.
I have heard, though, older people, this is a broad statement, complaining about mm-hmm. the younger generation, about millennials and others, that they are always on their phone and they don't work hard. You know, they're slackers, all of that. I mean, it seems like we've got the OK boomer thing, which you write about. But right. there's a little bit of a warfare going on between the generations, it seems.
Yes. And, you know, yeah, the OK boomer thing was a little bit of sort of the thumb or the finger at you know, at the boomers. But I have to say, you know, we have not left the best world to them.
No,
you know,
true that.
let's be honest about that. You know, the planet, global climate issues, you know, the polarization of our communities now. You know, we have been the group that has been in charge here, and so I think the millennials have ample reason to be unhappy with the state of things. And, you know, every generation does things its own way. You know, I remember when I was, you know, in my 20s, I was on the phone all the time too, but it was a landline. And, you know, it's just the advancing of technology. I actually urge people to embrace these technologies. And there's a chapter saying, I won't double space anymore. And for those of us who learned to type on a typewriter, we learned to double space because you needed to do that to see that a sentence was beginning. You don't need to do that anymore. And that's really, though, a metaphor about retraining your brain to learn new technologies, social media platforms, whatever, so that we can stay connected, so that we can stay in the conversation. And I think the more we have a conversation between generations, the less antagonism there will be from both sides.
Well, it's interesting what the pandemic taught us. I mean, it has taught us many things, but one is technology and connection.
Yeah. I mean, I had not really heard of Zoom, you know, a year and a half ago, and now it has been a lifeline. I'm, you know, connected to friends, work groups, my yoga classes, and you know, it really has been a plus, and so many other technologies helped us make it through those dark days and will help us as we go forward.
Let me take a couple of calls. A comment from Rick, who just says, speaking to what we were talking about earlier, I'm a retired colonel. I mentor young people. We teach each other and we share things. I feel like you need to pass along life lessons. Let me get Sean to join us. And Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yes. Thank you so much for having me. Sure. I am about to turn 30. So I am not quite the same age, but my mother is about to turn 60, and she had just lost her father, my grandfather, this past year, blessedly not from COVID, so we were able to be with him in his final moments. But something that I learned through that experience, that as I'm preparing to maybe become a caretaker for my mother, she just had a knee replaced. She just is starting to, I think, feel a lot of the things that you're talking about and the discrimination. She had to find a new job and face a lot of ageism through that. That letting what she did for her father that I plan to do with my mother is to treat her with dignity as she goes through her age. Let her make her own decisions. She's not going to disintegrate into dust if I let her cook her own dinner or lift her own packages to the best of her ability. But yeah, treat them with dignity as an adult child of someone who is getting older. That's the lesson that I've learned from seeing it in my own family.
Well, you sound like a good son. And Sean, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. Let me give Stephen Petro a chance to respond, because you do write in this book about from an older person not wanting to be a burden to their family. But that is such a tricky thing to do, to try to do.
Yes, yes. And Marty, I agree with you about Sean. He's a good son, and I'm sorry for the loss of your grandfather as well. My parents, they lived out on Long Island. They lived on a cliff. They literally lived on a cliff, and they were not near any of their kids. And so there was a time when we thought they might do better living in a continuing care community near my brother, and my brother took them to see one. And it was a very nice place, and they had lunch there, and there was a salmon dish. And at the end of the hour or so, my brother said to them, "So, Mom, what do you think?" And she said, and she was a very strident person, she said, "You know I don't like fish," which was her code for, "I'm never going to that place." And then my dad said, "We're going to age in place, thank you very much." And then they both said the refrain, "But we don't want to be a burden to you." And they stayed in the house they were at. They were a burden. We loved them, but it was hard for us. We lived 100, if not more, miles away. We had to take care of them, hire people, so on and so forth. And so I think we need to sort of listen to what we're actually saying and understand the result of that. And so this is an example, though, where I do not myself want to become a burden to my nieces. I don't have kids. And so I have signed up for one of those continuing care communities now. Mm-hmm. It was hard to do, you know, and I do like fish, and they had fish. but you're kind of looking into a future. But it's good to have these conversations, and then it's also good to have a plan A and have a plan B so that you do not become the burden that you really don't want to be.
Let me see what Peggy has to say. Peggy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, to you two children sitting there. I am 93.
Thank you.
93. You go, Peggy.
I told my friend, excuse me, they can't say I'm old. They have to say I'm older.
Got it.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, I didn't even notice I was getting old. I was so busy. And now that I am up in the 93s, we have things like Meals on Wheels, and all these people my age are saying the same thing. When your show came on, I had an 81-year-old lady bringing me Meals on Wheels, and she said the same thing. She said, "How do you know when you're old? It's only your health that makes a difference. And by the way,
yes,
dress the way you want to. Don't worry about what other people say."
There you go, Peggy. I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Stephen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, you're an inspiration. And I think you're also a really good example. You know, I said earlier that demographers have made this determination that old starts in your 70s. But into that are really personal elements, too, which, you know, what is your mental health, your sense of optimism, your physical activity? And so the way, you know, we can stay more in the stream, more in the swim, is to work on those things. And then we kind of push it off more. And you've obviously pushed it off quite a bit. And that's fantastic. You sound wonderful.
Yeah, Peggy, thanks for the call. Here's a comment from Anne. We could do a whole show about these Geico ads. She says, I'm 73. I love those Geico ads. If we don't have a sense of humor about aging, we are lost. And Stephen, I'm assuming you would agree with Anne.
I do agree with that. But I often think that we make targeted barbs under the guise of humor. And I grew up in New York City. I'm like very well practiced in that art. And so we have to be careful about humor and how humor is understood. It's tricky. So yes, sense of humor is really important, but we can't use that as kind of a carte blanche to say and do things that actually may be hurtful.
Well, let me segue from that to death. And I mean, it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's just true. The older you get, the more mortal you feel, the more you feel like, you know, that you're on the downward slope. There's, you know, less time in front of you than behind you. How do you think about death and your own death, obviously?
You know, I'm going to say this is, and it's going to sound strange. I had cancer when I was 26, testicular cancer. And so I faced my potential mortality much sooner than I might have otherwise, and didn't really understand. Well, I understood that I might not have a full life expectancy. So that was, you know, that's a silver lining and something that was really challenging. And it has stayed with me, and I've been involved in cancer communities and then through the AIDS epidemic, many of my colleagues and friends died. So it has not become this other fearful thing, which I understand that it is for many people. And so the last part of the book is about death and dying and how we can take on some of those issues and talk about them. There's a chapter, and with humor, and there's a chapter about my parents. They were out on Long Island, as I mentioned. And they knew where they wanted to be buried, but they didn't want to tell their children because that would make it more finite. And so finally we got them to the cemetery after my mother was making numerous appointments for her hair or for the dog to go to the vet. And she said at one point, you know, if you just give me a gin and tonic, I say yes. And then my dad followed suit. And then I wrote about that particular story in the New York Times, and my mother was reading it next to me that morning, and she goes, look at this, Stephen. I told you other people had trouble choosing where they wanted to be buried. And this lady, too, she wanted a gin and tonic, and her son got her one. And I said, that's right, Mom. And, you know, we talked about this, and I got your permission. Look who wrote that. So you know, that was kind of a heavy series of topics in that piece, and it's in the book. And, you know, to bring some lightness to it, to show how others have done it is part of what I'm doing. You know, there's another chapter. It's about a friend of mine, Jackie Zinn, and she passed from brain cancer at the age of 56. And when she realized that she was going to die, she wrote a number of letters to each of her four children that they would then open throughout their lifetimes. And that was such an act of courage and stepping up and creating a legacy. And she did not, she did not run from it. And Marty, do we have time for me to read quick paragraph?
I wish we did. We don't. Okay. Stephen Petro, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And I should add that he is going to write his own obituary and plan his own funeral. That's Stephen Petro. And his book is called Stupid Things I Won't Do When I Get Old. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.